Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, the European Union's top diplomat on global efforts to get more aid into Gaza and to support Ukraine.
A legal settlement allows Florida teachers and students to talk about LGBTQ plus issues, but some restrictions remain.
And the pregnancy struggles of both Israeli survivors of October 7th and Gazans under siege.
I'm so exhausted. I can't even get up to play a mother's role in my baby's life. I can't walk or get up to feed him or hold him.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is taking on Israel's far-right government over the war in Gaza.
The highest-ranking Jewish elected official in the United States delivered a scathing 40-minute speech today. He charged that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has lost his way in the military drive to crush Hamas. Schumer said that Netanyahu and his government are an obstacle to peace and that Israel needs new elections.
The Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after October 7th. The world has changed radically since then, and the Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past.
Netanyahu's political party shot back that Israel is, quote, not a banana republic, and that its war policy has wide public support. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Palestinian officials said an aid warehouse was hit by an Israeli airstrike that killed 8 people. The Israelis said one was a Hamas commander. Palestinian Authority is getting a new prime minister, but the choice may not satisfy U.S. calls for reforms leading to a Palestinian state. President Mahmoud Abbas today named economist Mohammed Mustafa to the post. He's a longtime ally to Abbas, and whether he'll undertake real change is unclear. A federal judge in Florida has rejected former President Trump's motion to dismiss the classified documents case against him. Mr. Trump is accused of illegally storing sensitive records at his Mar-a-Lago estate after leaving office. Today's ruling came after Trump lawyers argued the law is vaguely worded and that he was allowed to keep anything he designated as personal. Prosecutors disputed those claims and said Mr. Trump urged others to lie and cover up. President Biden came out today against the planned sale of U.S. steel to a Japanese firm, saying it would harm American workers. That came as he made a campaign visit to Saginaw, Michigan. It was aimed at building support from Black and union voters. And in Minnesota, Vice President Harris stopped at a Planned Parenthood facility that offers abortion services. It was said to be the first time that a sitting president or vice president has toured that kind of clinic. Former Trump Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin has announced he's organizing a group of investors to buy TikTok. That comes after the House voted to ban the video sharing app in the U.S. unless it cuts ties with a Chinese-owned parent company. Mnuchin did not say who might be in that investor group. In Japan, a high court ruled that denying same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. The court has no power to overturn existing laws that restrict marriage. Instead, it urged the government to do so. Crowds in Tokyo cheered and hailed the decision as a step toward equality. But plaintiffs in the court case called the ruling only a partial victory.
I still think that we are so far behind other countries. We can't really be compared to them. It feels like Japan is the only country that's not changing. Even though our society is really changing, Japan alone has not changed at all. I am boiling with anger.
Japan is the only member of the G7 industrial democracies that does not have legal protections for same-sex unions. The Elon Musk company SpaceX reached a kind of milestone today with the third test of its giant Starship rocket, but its luck didn't last. The unmanned spacecraft blasted off from South Texas and had a flawless flight for about an hour. But the rocket was apparently destroyed as it headed for a splashdown in the Indian Ocean. Two previous test flights ended in explosions just after liftoff. On Wall Street, mixed economic data led stocks lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 137 points to close at 38,905. The Nasdaq fell 49 points. The S&P 500 slipped 14. And a passing of note. A leading civil rights activist of the 1960s, Dorie Ann Ladner, died Monday in Washington. She began fighting for justice and equality as a teenager in her home state of Mississippi, and she was involved in every major civil rights protest of the 60s. Dorie Ann Ladner was 81 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, outrage and concern over the treatment of black women in higher education, how quantum computing could help us understand more about the universe and beyond. The mother of slain journalist James Foley discusses her new book about her son, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Biden administration is struggling to find solutions to two major foreign policy challenges, creating a ceasefire in the war in Gaza and helping fund Ukraine's war against Russia. In each case, it's working with the European Union, whose foreign policy chief is visiting Washington. Nick Schifrin sat down with him today.
And we're now joined by the High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy for the European Union, Josep Borrell. Thank you very much. Welcome back to the NewsHour. Let me start with Israel and Gaza. Today, as you saw, the Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, made a speech at Congress, and he said that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been too willing to tolerate the civilian toll in Gaza, which is pushing support for Israel worldwide to historic lows. Do you agree?
Well, I perceive a change on the mood of the public opinion in the U.S. with respect to what's happening in Gaza. More and more people are feeling concerned with what I certainly can call a massacre, because 30,000 civilians killed is a lot of people. President Biden and Vice President Kamala has been saying there are too many, certainly. And it is not just in the U.S. It's true that the whole world is concerned about what's happening there.
I think the majority leader's criticism was almost personal to the prime minister, to Benjamin Netanyahu. Do you agree with his criticism of Netanyahu specifically?
We at the European Union, we have priorities. One of the priorities would be to look for a two-state solution and to give the Palestinian the right to have its own land, its own government. And certainly, we would prefer to have a leader who could be compatible with this approach.
And it sounds like you don't think Netanyahu is compatible with that approach?
Well, Netanyahu has been saying and re-saying that he is the most firm opponent to this solution.
This week, you told the Security Council that Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war. How so?
Do you think there is starvation in Gaza? Yes, it is a starvation in Gaza. Hundreds of thousands of people are starving, literally. Among them, many children being dying by malnutrition. If there is a starvation, why is this a starvation? Because there is not enough humanitarian support entering to support these people. And why is it? Because Israel is controlling the border and not letting humanitarian support to come in. So it is a logical consequence, no? You prevent humanitarian support from coming and people are starving. Isn't it a logical cause and effect then?
But accusing them of having, of using it as a weapon of war is suggesting they are doing so purposely. Israel specifically says that there is no restriction on the number of aid trucks getting in or the amount of aid getting in, and they blame the United Nations and a lack of capacity for the lack of aid.
Well, I don't think so.
Why not? What's your evidence that it is Israel's fault?
There's a lot of evidence that the controls in the border prevent the support to come in. I don't think Israel can say that it's doing everything in order to support coming into Gaza.
In the same speech where you accused Israel of using food as a weapon of war, you did not call on Hamas to release the hostages or lay down their arms.
Come on, I'm saying that every time. Every time I take the floor, I start saying that the freedom of the hostages is a must, and Hamas has to release it. We have been saying and re-saying and repeating, and I don't care to say it again, that Hamas is considered a terrorist organization, that they launch an attack that is completely unacceptable, and the hostages has to be freed.
Let's switch to Ukraine. Have you been able to speak to Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, to urge him to allow for a vote for the $60 billion military and economic aid support package for Ukraine that has been stalled in the House?
No, not with the Speaker of the House, but I had the opportunity to talk with some members of the member of the House from the Republican side. And I tried to explain him and ask him to explain to their colleagues, just imagine which could be the consequences of a blockage of the American support to Ukraine. Just imagine the Russian tanks breaking the defense lines of Ukraine, heading to Kyiv, putting a puppet government in Kyiv, putting the Ukrainian people under an authoritarian regime, and we know how the Russian authoritarian regime works, putting the Russian army in the borders of Poland and the Baltics, being a serious threat to Moldova. The security cost for us Europeans and for you, US people, of a Russian victory in Ukraine is so great, so big, so unbearable, that I urge everybody to understand that the support to Ukraine has to continue, not only for generosity with the people who are defending themselves from an invasion, but also in our own interest.
Can the European Union provide military aid to Ukraine that is in enough quantity to replace American military assistance?
From the military point of view, no, you have been a stronger supporter because you have a stronger military capacity. Nobody can compete with the U.S. Army and the U.S. military capacities. And certainly, if you could stop doing that, no one else can take your place.
There are already questions in Europe, as you know, about U.S. reliability. I've been told that there's military planning, for example, in Germany, if the U.S. withdraws from NATO. There are even people considering whether the United Kingdom and France should offer a nuclear security guarantee to Europe. Do you support some of those conversations?
Well, there is not alternative for NATO to ensure Europe in front of a territorial threat that Russia can represent. But at the same time, there is a growing feeling among Europeans that we have to develop more our own capacities, just in case that in the future we should take more responsibility from our side. And this is not a bad news. By the contrary, I think that this war has represented a wake-up for the European strategic thinking. It's a general feeling among the Europeans that we live in a challenging world, that we make peace among us, but peace is not the rule, and we have to be ready to face a challenge.
And is it not only about the war, is it also about the Republican nominee for president of the United States, Donald Trump, who called the European Union an economic foe, and who has questioned whether the United States, if he were to be reelected, would defend NATO allies under Article 5?
Well, if Trump is reelected, we will think about Trump. By the time being, we think about Biden.
Josep Borrell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Students and teachers in Florida can now discuss sexual orientation and gender identity in a classroom setting as long as it's not part of formal instruction. That's an important change that's part of a new settlement reached between state education officials and civil rights attorneys who challenged a law labeled by critics as the Don't Say Gay Law. Here's Stephanie Tsai.
Jeff, this may be a state law, but it has reached beyond Florida, with other conservative states inspired by the prohibitions. What the law has meant in Florida is teachers afraid to even use the words gay or transgender when speaking to students outside the classroom, or even celebrating their own identity or support of the LGBTQ community with, say, rainbow stickers. But with this settlement, at least some of those concerns may be put to rest. Joe Saunders with Equality Florida, an LGBTQ advocacy group, told us this.
There is no question that following this settlement, students, teachers, parents of LGBTQ students, and LGBTQ parents can say gay, can say trans, can be gay, can be trans in Florida's public school system and not be afraid of the bullying and the weaponization of this law to lead to sweeping censorship.
However, the law was not repealed and still forbids explicit class curriculum dealing with LGBTQ topics. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis called the settlement a major win this week. For more on what this all means, I'm joined by Danielle Pryor, education reporter with WMFE, the NPR affiliate in Orlando. Danielle, thank you for joining the NewsHour. Help us understand what this settlement actually changed. I understand the text of the law was altered.
So it actually clarified the language of the law. The law was quite vague. And moving forward, as we heard in your clip, parents and teachers and students will be able to speak freely and write freely about gender identity and sexuality in classroom discussions, on essays, on projects. Kids can read books again with gay characters. Teachers can put safe space stickers up and also have gay straight alliances and other kind of LGBTQ clubs at schools. So it really gutted large parts of the law and clarified it.
But Danielle, the law does still remain in effect. What restrictions are still in place?
Yeah, so the law still bans outright instruction about gender identity and sexuality here in Florida. So that would include like a class or a book or even a unit in a section of a textbook that would instruct people in any way about gender identity and sexuality. So the law is still in effect, as well as a lot of the policies that were kind of inspired by the law, things like banning AP African American history because there was a queer theory unit, or, you know, making it so that sociology is no longer a core curriculum course for undergrads here because it talked about human sexuality. So a lot of the law and the policies around the law still are very much in effect here in Florida.
It's interesting that it seems both sides of this, both LGBTQ advocates as well as Governor DeSantis, seem to view this as a good thing. How do you figure that?
Yeah, so basically the law is not overturned and it's not repealed. It's still very much in effect. So that's a win for the governor and for his party. This was a big win for his conservative base in 2022 when it was passed. But it's also a big win for LGBTQ advocates, folks who have lived under this law for 2 years and were afraid to be out publicly in the school system, fearing, you know, what might happen. Said the wrong thing, or as a teacher, maybe had the wrong book in their classroom. So this is a really kind of huge moment for the state of Florida.
You have been reporting on the impacts, Danielle, of this law, the impacts it's had on kids and families who identify as LGBTQ. What has it been like for them since this law passed, and how are they reacting to the settlement?
I've spoken to so many people who, whether they're a teacher who's gay or a student who's gay, who felt like they really couldn't be gay, felt like they had to either stay in the closet or go back in the closet, felt just very hurt and very sad by the fact that a big part of their identity was something that was somehow not appropriate enough to have in Florida schools. So this is such a win and such a celebratory time and celebration for them. I spoke with several plaintiffs who were on the lawsuit that kind of resulted in this settlement, and they said that their 10-year-old son just said, wow, does this mean we can finally say gay? Can we finally say gay, mom? And look what we did. So this is a big moment, I think, for LGBTQ people throughout the state of Florida.
And yet other conservative states use this Florida law as a template for their own prohibitions. When it comes to Florida, where does it go from here as far as legislation that would impact its LGBTQ citizens?
Well, our legislative session, our last one, just ended on Friday, and most of our strongest anti-LGBTQ and anti-trans bills actually died in session. So there's kind of a trend that we're seeing that this kind of anti-LGBTQ push that was so strong before is weakening a bit here in Florida. And I know a lot of the plaintiffs on the lawsuit and people that were a part of the settlement really hope people in other states are paying close attention, because they said, look what we did. Look what we were able to accomplish. There were protests at local high schools when this bill, you know, became a law. And obviously this lawsuit itself shows sometimes when you speak up and you speak up and fight for a long time, that things can change. So they're hoping to inspire other people in states that still have kind of strong anti-LGBTQ laws in place. And of course, Florida itself still has a lot of those laws in place, things like, you know, a ban on gender affirming care. So we'll have to see kind of the ripple effects of this settlement here in Florida and throughout the country.
Absolutely. Danielle Pryor with WMFE in Orlando. Thanks so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
Of the many horrors endured by Palestinians and Israelis since the Hamas attacks of October 7th, perhaps none is more acute than those of expectant mothers. For the last several months, special correspondent Leila Molana Allen has been charting the progress of their pain, their pregnancies, their sorrows, and their joys. She brings us their stories now.
Each day in Gaza, mothers search desperately for food for their children. By night, as Israeli airstrikes pound the strip, they pray those children will live to see morning. Expectant mothers live in fear their babies will never be born at all. An estimated 50,000 women in Gaza are currently pregnant, with about 180 babies being born each day. Medical staff report newborns being birthed on blood-soaked floors and in dirty bathrooms of overwhelmed hospitals, and cesarean sections carried out without anesthetic. 3 months ago, Emanuel Bashliki had an emergency C-section after she went into labor while fleeing heavy bombing in North Gaza.
They bombed all the hospitals in the north in the Jabalia camp, and the bombing was happening over our heads.
Her displaced family is now living in filthy conditions, so the wounds from her cesarean surgery have become badly infected. With medical stocks almost wiped out, she's hoping the doctors will still have enough antibiotics left to help her.
I'm so exhausted. I can't even get up to play a mother's role in my baby's life. I can't walk or get up to feed him or hold him.
Trapped by bombing for weeks, 3 months pregnant Iman Mashayer finally made it here for a checkup. The doctors had devastating news. There was no heartbeat. Worse still, they haven't been able to operate to remove the fetus because there are just too many critically injured patients they have to treat first. If a man has to wait much longer, sepsis could kill her.
I've known for a month now that my baby is dead, and they still haven't removed it because of the huge numbers of people here. I'm scared because I have to have an operation without any anesthesia. The doctor says I might become poisoned by the failed pregnancy.
Severe malnutrition, scarce clean water, and dire living conditions are leading to a massive rise in premature and underweight births, miscarriages, and death of mothers and newborns. Most of Gaza's hospitals have collapsed thanks to Israel's aerial bombardment and the siege, cutting off medical supplies and electricity. Rafah's Emirati Hospital is still hanging on. Doctors and midwives here do what they can to cope. Dr. Sana El-Jazar is a resident pediatrician.
There is a high percentage of critical cases coming in and a high percentage of death. A lot of women are giving birth prematurely as a result of fear and the war and the chaotic living circumstances. After the women go home with their babies, they come back a few days later because their babies have dehydration, or they have diarrhea, or they're vomiting.
UNICEF's Tess Ingram was horrified by the condition she found mothers and babies enduring on a recent visit.
It is unbelievable what is happening here at the Emirati Hospital. The situation is very desperate. Some of the mothers haven't made it through giving birth. We're calling for an immediate ceasefire so that the fighting can stop and so that UNICEF and other aid agencies can bring them the help that they need.
As Hamas rockets continue to fall across the border in Israel, expectant mothers live in the shadow of this war. Ilana Polat is a midwife at Sderot Hospital, one of the largest in southern Israel. The maternity clinic here has been moved into a reinforced concrete shelter after multiple rockets hit the hospital.
Very scary for women, very scary for the families and for the babies, because, you know, any time we can hear a siren and we are not in the protected area, and we need to run. And women after birth with epidural cannot run, so it's feeling. Yes, it's here. We can now. Maybe we will hear the siren here. So it's very emotional time and very stressful time.
Noor Sarfati thought she wouldn't survive to see her second child born, or be able to save her first. On October 7th, she, her husband, and their toddler Michael hid for a full day and night as Hamas terrorists rampaged through their hometown of Kibbutz Kfar Aza on the Gaza border, killing everyone they could find.
זה קשה לי נורא לדבר על השעות האלה, אבל אתה פשוט יושב ומחכה שיהרגו אותו.
I find it extremely hard to talk about those hours. I sat there waiting for them to kill him. I could barely look at my son because I understood in my head that his life was about to end. And imagine thinking that for 25 hours.
In her second trimester, as the hours ticked by and she grew weaker, Noah felt sure she would lose the baby. Finally, they were rescued by IDF soldiers the next morning. High school teacher Noah used to be liberal to her core. She taught her students to value all life on both sides of the border. Now, she doesn't know if she'll ever feel safe again.
ועכשיו זה השתנה. לא אכפת לי יותר, לא אכפת לי יותר מאף אחד בעזה.
Everything has changed. I don't care about anyone in Gaza anymore. I won't forgive them. When something like that happens, something very, very deep breaks inside you.
Noah says she'll never go back to Kfar Aza. She's now had a baby boy, Yair, and hopes they'll find a new home with what's left of their community. Back in Gaza, displaced multiple times and under daily bombardment, new mothers have nowhere safe to go. But barely functioning hospitals have no space to keep them. If they're lucky enough to survive a safe birth in these conditions, they go home to filthy, freezing cold shelters, living on a single meal a day. Baby formula has run out. To breastfeed, mothers need to drink 16 cups of water a day. Gazans are currently lucky to find 2 cups.
If people don't have sympathy for newborn babies, for the elderly, for children living on the streets, then I don't know what to say after everything they've seen.
Jawahar Assad gave birth an hour ago, but she hasn't been able to hold her baby Yaman yet. He's in intensive care. They're both facing life-threatening breathing issues because of the toxic smoke Jawahar has been breathing in from the improvised stove they use to keep warm.
This pregnancy was really hard on me. There is no food. I haven't eaten in a week.
Jawahar doesn't know how she'll feed baby Yaman or the 12 other bereaved kids from her extended family waiting back in their tent.
Our kids don't deserve to live any of this, to be thrown into the streets without food, without shelter, even without clothes. The rain and cold pour down on us and we don't have anywhere to take shelter. And now I've given birth. God save us from what we're living.
The UN has called Gaza a graveyard for children. Nearly 12,500 Gazan children have been killed since Israel's attack began. That's more than the total number of children killed in all other global conflicts in the previous 4 years combined. Mothers, desperate to keep their children safe, can do little but pray for an end to their nightmare. As this brutal war lurches on, hopes of a peaceful future for Palestinian and Israeli children look starker than ever. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Leila Milana Allen on the Israel-Gaza border.
The death of an administrator at Lincoln University in Missouri earlier this year has sparked outrage and broader concern about the treatment of black women in higher education. Antoinette Candia Bailey died by suicide in January and left scathing letters where she alleged a pattern of bullying and harassment at the hands of the university's president, John B. Mosley. He is now on paid administrative leave pending an investigation. That came just weeks after Harvard's former president, Claudine Gay, resigned under pressure. All of it leading to a dialogue in academia about the particular challenges and pressures that black women face. We spoke to a few women about this as part of our ongoing coverage of Race Matters, and here's part of what they told us.
I'm Keisha Thomas. I'm at the University of Alabama at Birmingham.
My name is Dr. Candace Parrish, and I am currently a visiting assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington.
My name is Shea Crowder, and I am an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles.
I certainly had not been exposed to a case as tragic as Dr. Bailey's, although for those of us in higher ed, especially those of us who are in senior positions or leadership positions, it is often a conversation around the chronic stress that we experience, the burnout that is experienced, but also the isolation that has followed us for our entire careers.
I was very sad that it had gone so far and that she felt like she did not have the resources or what she needed to overcome this sort of situation. And it just got me thinking about how many more people like myself actually experience these sort of travesties in academia.
I have absolutely experienced microaggressions with regard to the intersection of both my race and gender. In my entire time in my PhD program, there was never another Black person above me or below me in American politics. And so it was a very isolating experience.
I have had those experiences, as have my colleagues, and it's not simply within our career. It starts in college and graduate school, and some of us even earlier. And so many of us, you know, see our education as an investment in our future and the futures of our families.
In my PhD program, it was a very, very tough experience in which there were several periods where I almost quit. There was a lack of support, and there were people who were in charge of my academic destiny as a PhD student who were manipulating things to go against my favor.
With everything happening in the world right now, when there are coordinated efforts on the part of, you know, individuals and institutions to attack the credibility of your academic work, and that's already something that, you know, brings anxieties, it can be, you know, particularly distressing.
Some of what we've talked about today, I've heard similar complaints from colleagues in law and medicine, industries across the board. I think higher ed is different because oftentimes we are so severely underrepresented.
I've actually stopped recommending academia as a valid job and community position to young people who want to pursue PhDs in teaching. I cannot vouch for their experiences, knowing the horrible things that I have gone through and how much emotional time and space it has taken.
Let's talk more about the particular stresses that Black women in academia face. Dr. Bridget Goosby is professor of sociology and co-director of the Life HD Health Disparities Research Lab at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
Two consistent themes we heard from the professors who spoke with us: the sense of isolation and a lack of support. How does that square with what you found in your own research?
That is definitely commensurate with what we're finding in the work that we're doing right now, collecting data on Black women faculty on the tenure track, that they do experience forms of isolation, feeling like they are left out. Networks are not available to them that are available to their colleagues. And the experiences of this lack of support that they have is definitely something that we're seeing in the work that we're doing.
And we should say that academia can be a high pressure, high stress, intense, some might say toxic environment, no matter one's background. What are some of the particular pressures that Black women face in higher education?
This speaks to what the women in the interviews were already saying, which is that we tend to be underrepresented. We make up 3.7% of overall of tenure track faculty in the United States. And so when we think about the high pressure of the positions of being faculty members, this means that on top of the stress and demand of being researchers, productive researchers, successful teachers, we also are in a space where people may not even recognize that we are the onlys, and that our experience is unique, and that we are more likely to experience racism and sexism, the intersections of those things in those spaces. We're also more likely to be cut out of networks because we don't fit necessarily, because we are so underrepresented. So there are a litany of different situations that make our experience as Black women unique in the stressful conditions that we face as tenure track faculty or faculty in higher education.
What do viable solutions look like at this point?
Well, viable solutions would be, one, identifying the stressors that Black women are facing and trying to mitigate the situations that they're in, protections for women who are experiencing racism, harassment, discrimination in these spaces, recognizing the fact that we come from a historically disadvantaged group and are underrepresented, which means that in these spaces, we are experiencing a lot of these kinds of stressors without the kinds now, increasingly, possibly without the kinds of protections that we would like to see more of moving forward.
How has the conservative crackdown on DEI initiatives, diversity, equity, and inclusion, how has that affected the effort to attract and retain Black women in higher education?
So this is, you know, we're still in the nascent stages of this, but I will say that it is definitely something that's going to continue to have a chilling effect on the ability to recruit and retain Black women in academia. As was mentioned, can you really advise women to go into, Black women to go into these spaces when we're being publicly kind of singled out and discredited? And now without the kind of protections of DEI, which was, you know, as a system, was there to kind of help with increasing diversity and inclusion overall, being gone, this means that this could be a complicated situation for Black women to be in without having the kinds of protections that might have been put forward by DEI previously.
Dr. Bridget Gooseby, we appreciate your insights and your time this evening. Thank you.
Thank you.
Scientists, researchers, and some big companies are eager to jumpstart the next generation of computing, one that will be far more sophisticated and dependent on understanding the subatomic nature of the universe. But it's a huge challenge to take this new quantum leap forward. Science correspondent Miles O'Brien has more.
Okay.
It's a chandelier that may soon shed light on the true nature of nature. A quantum computer designed to understand the rules of the physical world, to find new ways to cure diseases, stop pandemics, develop renewable energy, and tackle the climate emergency.
If we want to understand nature, since nature obeys quantum mechanics, let's build a machine, let's build technology that works like nature.
Dario Gil is a senior vice president and the director of IBM Research in Yorktown Heights, New York. Computers today operate in the binary language of ones and zeros. Fast and capable, sure, but they are, after all, digital totems of reality.
So no matter how hard we try, the best we can do is to approximate the complexity of our world. And quantum machines are the first technology that we've created that allows us to, by mimicking that behavior of the natural world of quantum physics, to be able to simulate it, to understand it better.
These intricate machines are designed to do just that. At the bottom are simulated atomic particles called qubits, which act in mysterious, non-intuitive ways. The manner in which they spin and interact can greatly increase the capability and efficiency of computers. Besides being a potential game changer for solving problems in the natural world, quantum computers may lead to greater optimization in manufacturing, logistics, transportation, and finance, and they have the potential to challenge and revolutionize encryption.
I believe we are at the birth of a revolution in technology, a different way of thinking about information.
Quantum physicist David Aschalam is a professor at the Pritzker School of Molecular Engineering and Physics at the University of Chicago.
Well, I think our classical view of the world and classical modeling of the world has worked very well, and it's helped us quite a bit, and it continues to help us. But some of us think about this moving a little bit from a world of black and white into color.
He gave me a tour of his quantum measurement laboratory.
What is the goal of this lab anyway? What are you up to here?
Yeah, so here we're developing new experimental techniques to be able to look at individual electrons and atoms and see how they convey quantum information.
They combine fast pulses of light and microwaves to experiment with individual atoms and electrons.
And measure their properties as a way to investigate them, atom and electron by atom.
So you're able to manipulate at the atomic level.
Correct.
You're controlling atoms.
With microwaves, and we probe them with pulses of light.
But controlling atoms is no small feat. It turns out qubits are very delicate, creating a big engineering challenge in designing quantum computers.
So we are in the Google Quantum AI lab, and we are surrounded by a fleet of quantum computers.
Physicist Eric Lucero is a lead engineer for Google's quantum computing enterprise based in Santa Barbara, California.
Each one of these we're testing something slightly different.
Quantum computers look like a Rube Goldberg espresso maker in order to keep their finicky qubits happy. For them to remain able to compute problems, they cannot be disturbed by the slightest bit of noise, electromagnetic or thermal.
We want to make sure that the thermal noise is well below our quantum signal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we make our systems out of superconducting electronics.
Which means they have to be kept cold, extremely cold. Everywhere we went, the computers had to be chilled to almost absolute zero, or about 460 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. Simply sending commands to and receiving responses from qubits without disturbing them is a Herculean task.
We're learning about information that it's so much more delicate in the ways that we have to interact with it. When we go and actually interact with these systems, we can alter it.
As a result, the quantum computers that exist today are riddled with errors. Researchers deal with this through statistical analysis and sophisticated error correction techniques. But achieving a fully error-corrected quantum computer is their goal.
The summit for us is to build a fault-tolerant, error-corrected quantum computer.
The race is on to be first, and China appears to be the leader. Its announced investment in quantum computing is more than $15 billion. IBM and Google don't share the amount they are spending internally on quantum computing research and development. But in May of 2023, the companies announced a $150 million gift to the universities of Chicago and Tokyo to try and keep pace with the Chinese.
You're probably standing between two of the biggest quantum computers in the world.
So if I stay here long enough, I'll get smarter?
Possibly.
Back in Yorktown Heights, I met IBM's VP of Quantum, Jay Gambetta. The company is already rolling out quantum computers that are not perfect, but are built with some error correction.
If we can increase the rate at which we can scale whilst continuing to make improvements on the performance, we'll be in a point where these will be able to do something we could never do with classical computing.
The company has already deployed more than 75 quantum computers. Mostly, users are trying to find ways to program these machines. It's entirely different than classical computer coding.
It is definitely going to be a huge competition. I think this needs to be the decade where quantum computing emerges as a technology that will be a permanent part of the landscape of the world of computing. But a race also has a connotation that, like, you run something and it ends. I don't see this as ending.
Researchers say a practical, error-free quantum computer may be a decade away. But the goal of solving huge problems with the smallest particles in the universe is alluring enough to quicken their work. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Yorktown Heights, New York.
Tomorrow marks 13 years since the beginning of the Syrian civil war. What began as a civil uprising against President Bashar al-Assad is a conflict that's now killed an estimated 500,000 people. One group fighting the Assad regime is the Islamic State, or ISIS, who've also targeted journalists. Jim Foley was an American journalist covering the war when he was kidnapped by ISIS terrorists in 2012 and publicly beheaded 2 years later. His murder shocked the world. A decade later, his mother, Diane Foley, tells Jim's story and how she came to be a leading advocate for Americans held hostage abroad. That's all in her new book, American Mother. And Diane Foley joins me now. Welcome back to the NewsHour.
Thank you.
So you have joined us here on the NewsHour many times to talk about Jim, to talk about the extraordinary work that you do. What was it that told you you had to pull all of this together in a book right now?
I really think the way we remember where we've been and our challenges going forward is by telling stories. Jim was a storyteller. All that you do, you help us remember what is happening in the world. And Jim, it was time. I was feeling that it's been 10 years. Some people were children when this happened to Jim. And we have accomplished a lot as U.S. government. I'm so grateful for all the good people who've stepped up and made it happen, donated, been so generous. But the challenges are great. And I just felt it was time to tell the story and learn from it, if you would, and to inspire others, take up the torch.
I notice even as we're sitting here, your eyes occasionally flick over to the photo and Jim's face. Mm. What's it like for you to see that photo?
Oh, Jim was he was the oldest of our five children, a beloved son, but he's challenged me. He's challenged me because I failed him, Amna. I did. Our government failed him. We failed. These young Americans, not just Jim, Stephen Sotloff, Peter Kasich, and Kayla, as well as Luke Summers and Warren Weinstein were killed in that same time frame. So we failed. And we are learning. President Obama set up the hostage fusion cell that still exists. We have a brilliant current hostage special envoy at the State Department. Mm-hmm. More than 100 people have come home since 2014. A lot of good things to celebrate. But the challenge remains. More and more countries are targeting our citizens. And we're very challenged as the Foley Foundation, as is our government, to handle it all.
You open this book, Diane, with an absolutely astonishing moment, which is when you sit down in the same room across the table from one of the men who kidnapped your son and brutally tortured your son and had pled guilty to the role he played in your son's death. And one of the first things you say to him as you sit down is, "Good morning. You can call me Diane." Wow. What made you want to go sit down and talk to him?
A lot of things. Jim would have talked to him. Jim would have wanted to hear him out. Jim had worked with a lot of disenfranchised young people like Alexander, who was so vulnerable to all the radicalization. But I also, as a mom, wanted to tell him who Jim was. And I really wanted to be able to see him as a human being who had made some horrific choices. And it was good. It was good. I was grateful that God gave me the strength to do it.
You also write about yourself and your husband, John, at one point, and you say, "It is incredible, though, what you don't know about your own child." Mm-hmm. Maybe it's the same for every parent, but it struck John and me years later that we didn't really know Jim all that well, not in his entirety, until after he was gone.
I know.
What did you learn about your son?
So much. Jim was our oldest, and because we had four others, I was quite busy. and with the younger ones and working part-time, and I love my work as a nurse practitioner. So Jim, when he came home, wanted to interview us, wanted to know how we were, what's up, what's going on, and really didn't share a lot about what he was up to. He really didn't share a lot, I realized. And it was really only after his death that I realized how many people he'd touched, how many lives he'd mentored. I had no clue about any of it because Jim never talked about it.
you know?
You mentioned the foundation that now carries his name, the James Foley Foundation. You've already changed how this U.S. government handles hostage affairs. You advocate for the dozens of Americans who are still held hostage abroad right now. But I should note, I see how hard you work. Others who know this work see that your own family has asked you to slow down. What is it that keeps you so devoted and so dedicated and moving forward every single day?
Well, I'm challenged by the needs that continue. We've definitely improved as a government, but we have a long ways to go. I mean, we have nation states that are targeting our citizens now and wrongfully arresting them. We've got to figure out how to deter this practice. We must, because a lot of people are still suffering. And it's still hard to get the attention for some of these families. Even with the wrongful detention process, it's rather opaque. We're struggling, working with our government to try to figure out ways to help people understand where they are in the process and what is possible for the government, what is not, what we need third-party experts to help with. Our government can't do everything. So that's partly our role, trying to help families figure out how to get the attention they need to bring their loved one home.
What do you think Jim would think of the work you're doing today?
I think he'd be doing some of it, to be honest, although I don't think he would have left his beloved journalism. He believed in the power of journalism, and he really believed that we had to be in conflict zones. We had to bear witness. He really believed in that. So I think he'd be doing what he was doing, and I think he would want someone to be advocating for those who are targeted and held hostage.
The book is American Mother, co-written by Colm McCann and Diane Foley. Diane, always a pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Emma.
And join us again here tomorrow night for Omna's exclusive interview with Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Omna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.